Good morning, everyone. Easter Sunday today. So in honor of that, I chose the topic Awakenings. This is springtime, and it's fashionable nowadays for people to accuse Easter of being a pagan holiday because of Easter bunnies and Easter eggs and things like that, and it comes at springtime and everything. But I think it's very, very appropriate that it coincides with springtime, because everything about Easter is about rebirth and reawakening, and everything about spring is also about a reawakening. So it's a perfect time to think about this reawakening from a spiritual sense. Being reborn in a spiritual sense. Every tradition has this idea and this concept. We have this, the Dwijas in Hindu tradition, those who have a second birth. Then Christianity, of course, being reborn in the spirit. And Buddha, the enlightened one, he was awakened. He was also a kind of rebirth. So this is really what we're trying to do. We're trying to wake up. We had a beautiful song that refers to the Kathopanishad, which we'll also refer to later. So this is a very important theme that we have, and something that we have to remind ourselves of, because we fall into lethargy and we fall into a very comfortable type of pattern sometimes and forget what spiritual life is really all about. So this morning, I thought I would speak about this topic of awakenings. And we see really that this is, it's not just poetry. When we look at every tradition, when we look at all of the great saints, we find that there's some major turning point. In fact, we'll see generally two turning points, which will be one of the themes this morning, that there's always an initial awakening, which will lead to some ultimate type of experience. And we find in many traditions, this will be some type of enlightenment or nirvana or feeling of liberation. So it's very important that we understand both the value and necessity of this initial awakening, but not think that once we've had that initial awakening, the job is done. That's actually the beginning of the job. And then we have to strive to have that ultimate type of awakening. So we see that there is a kind of two-tier concept here, which we have throughout Vedanta. We find so many of the ideas that we have will represent, one will be an initial stage and one will be a final stage. We have this the same idea with grace. We talk about grace. What is the meaning of grace? We have the type of grace which first wakes us up. Something happens, something enters into our hearts, and we awaken from some darkness, some tamas, some materialistic view of life. This isn't the final grace. This doesn't mean we've realized anything, but is it necessary? So we have some very nice allegories, you can say, to explain this. Sri Ramakrishna tells the story of a king in a small kingdom who had a number of poor subjects in his kingdom, and he wanted to visit the home of one of them. So the first thing that he did was to send his assistants there, his ministers, to the house and tell them that one of these days the king will come. But in order to receive the king, you have to be prepared. So they're poor people. They didn't have tables and chairs and iced tea set and all of that. So the ministers provided everything for them. So this was that initial grace. When they get the news, the king will enter, that means God will enter into the heart, but the heart has to be prepared. So we need all of these divine attributes. These are the tables and the chairs. There's love and devotion and renunciation and surrender, all of the divine attributes. We need that so that ultimately we can have that final experience when the king himself comes, when the king enters into the house. So we see this with grace, the whole concept of devotion, bhakti. We have a type of devotion that is a spiritual path. But what is the end of that spiritual path? What are we trying to achieve through the path of devotion? Devotion. So bhakti in a higher sense. The same thing with the path of knowledge, jnana. We're not trying to achieve anything other than the attainment of knowledge itself. But we do it through the path of knowledge. So one will be a path, one will be the end, but they'll be the same. They'll look the same. They'll have the same terminology, the same name, whether it's grace or knowledge or devotion. But the final one will be something completely different. It'll be the ultimate transformation. The first one is equally important. Without that first type of awakening, we'll never get started in spiritual life. So many people feel that this is really the critical type of awakening that we have, that awakening from complacency, that awakening from a materialistic view of life so that we can get on a spiritual path. Because in Vedanta, just having a set of beliefs and leading a moral life, that's fine. That's good in itself. But there's an ultimate goal, which is to have some direct experience. If there's some truth, it has to be experienced. If our real nature is perfection, one with the divine, we have to be able to realize it. So that's the ultimate awakening, that ultimate enlightenment that we're all striving for. The initial experience may be so, or initial awakening may be so dramatic that we feel that the job is over. I often refer to a statement that Swami Nikhilananda used to make, that the light that you see is not at the end of the tunnel, it's at the beginning of the tunnel. So that means we're in a tunnel and we keep walking and walking and we see some light at the end. So we think that we'll get there and we'll be out of the tunnel. By the time we get there, we see that the light came from a different direction. So we see that we've entered the beginning. Not that we've reached the end, we've entered the beginning, but we have to see, when we see that initial light, then we know that we're on the right path. But we shouldn't confuse it. We shouldn't think that that initial awakening is everything, that we've attained the goal. And this is why Sri Ramakrishna also tells the story of the woodcutter, that there was a woodcutter who used to go every day, and he would chop wood and sell it for firewood. And then a holy man one day said to him, go further, Egyeparo, go deeper into the forest. So he went a little further and he found very valuable sandalwood trees. So he cut these down and he sold them to be used for sandalwood paste and incense and made a lot of money. And then he remembered that the holy man said, go forward. He didn't say stop, just take one step. So he went further the next day and he found a gold mine and a silver mine, and then finally he found a diamond mine and became fabulously wealthy. So that initial stage may come from the words of a holy person, however it comes, but we have to keep moving forward and forward. There may be little awakenings also along the way until we reach the very final stage. This two-tiered theory is something that we also see in the Bhagavad Gita. There's a very famous verse which clearly delineates two different stages in spiritual life. One is the Araruksu. Araruksu is somebody who's trying to climb up, someone who's trying to ascend to yoga, to reach union with God. For someone who's attempting that, then the means are intense activity. Now, we reach a stage where we've attain to some state of yoga, equanimity that way, but we haven't realized anything. But we reach a second tier where shamah karamuchade, the means at that time is quietude, surrender, grace, where we don't have to put forth the same type of effort, but it doesn't mean that we stop the effort because we've attained something. It means we've reached the stage where we no longer have that feeling, I can do everything on my own. We all know the story of the bird on the mast of the ship, that he gets sent out to sea and wants to find land, so flies in every direction until his wings are completely tired and doesn't find land anywhere, and then finally says, let me take refuge with the ship itself. Wherever the ship takes me, I'll be content. I'll go there. So this is the second stage, but it has to go where the ship goes. And the ship will carry it to the other shore, exactly where we want to go in the first place. Sri Ramakrishna also gives the illustration of the boatman, that he has to take his sailboat across to the other side of the river. But in the beginning, the sail is not up. He has to get out to the middle of the river to be able to catch the breeze that's blowing. So he has to work very hard. He has to use the oars and row the boat out there and then raise the sails and everything. Once the sails are up and it catches the breeze, then he sits back and relaxes. He has a smoke, Thakur says. He sits back and relaxes, has a smoke, and then the breeze itself carries him across. So we have these two stages. Thakur calls the first one Vaidhi Bhakti. This is spiritual practice according to certain rules and regulations, and especially having a fixed routine, preliminary devotional practices. And the second is Anuraga, or Raganuga Bhakti, where everything is spontaneous. It's not that we give up anything, but we don't have to put forth an effort. We shouldn't think in the beginning we strive hard to remember God and think of God, and then in the second stage we forget God. It's not like that. We reach the second stage and we don't have to make an effort, that the mind is perfectly in tune with the spiritual goal at that point, and everything is natural. And the nice thing is that Sri Ramakrishna says that once we reach this point, the goal is assured to us. We're on safe ground once we get there. This is that Aruna Udaya, the pink, rosy color in the sky that we see in the morning before the sun comes up. How long does it take for the sun to come up? Maybe 5 minutes, maybe 10 minutes, maybe a half hour. It doesn't matter, because we know that it's going to come up. There's no way to stop it. So this is that ultimate stage of awakening that we're striving for, but we have to work very hard. Sometimes, so there's this in-between. Initially, we have some awakening. Then that leads to this longing, which requires self-effort, and then that'll lead to a stage where we practice surrender, and then that will automatically lead to this very final stage of some type of direct experience, some type of real awakening, which is a liberating type of awakening, which is transformational, which will involve really shedding all of our old bondages and all of the things that make us feel weak and limited and restricted that way, so that we can really feel who we are, feel our own true nature. Swami Vivekananda, as we heard before, was very fond of this verse from the Katha Upanishad, Utishtada Jagrada Prapya Varani Bodhada. It goes on. It's part of the statement that Yama, the king of death, makes to Nachiketa. Nachiketa was Swamiji's favorite character from the Upanishads. He's a young boy. He's a young boy who, in order to keep the word of his father got angry at him because he was pestering him. His father was supposed to give away everything and sacrifice. So he said, to whom will you give me? And he said, I'll give you to death. So just out of anger. So he walked to the kingdom of death. And there's a long dialogue, of course, and he gets tempted with all sorts of things, but the only thing he wants is knowledge. The only thing he wants to know is the real nature of the self. And in the midst of this long dialogue, this king, Yama, king of death, tells him, arise, awake, and stop not till the goal is reached. This is the way Swamiji puts it. He gives lots of different endings to this verse. It's not really an exact translation. When we go through the complete works, we find at least 25 times Swamiji refers to this arise awake idea. And almost always it's in India. I think only one time in the West. Why was it always in India? Because he felt that the people in India, because of years of foreign domination, were asleep in the sleep of tamas, that they were covered with this darkness of ignorance and lack of effort to do anything, because they had been under the thumb of the British for so many years, and before that others. So he wanted to awaken them, not as the final awakening, but awaken them so that they could at least do something. Because this tamas, this darkness and indolence and laziness, it looks very similar to sattva, which is calmness and quiet. But there's a world of difference between the two. So he wanted them to first get up and be active. He once asked somebody, can you at least learn to tell a lie? At least show that you're alive, that you're living, do something. Yeah. So he wanted to awaken them, that initial awakening, so that they could really come to that knowledge of their true nature and their oneness with the divine. The other great example we have of this two-tiered awakening is the life of Buddha also. He was a prince in a small kingdom. In those days, there were lots of little kingdoms. Not that it was a very huge kingdom with a lot of wealth or anything, but he was a prince nonetheless. And his parents knew from his horoscope at birth that either he would be a great ruler or he would become a wandering mendicant monk who would be a great spiritual luminary in the world. So naturally, they wanted him to stay home and take over the kingdom and have a family and all of that. So they were very protective of him. They wouldn't let him go outside the temple or the palace compound. It only took four trips for his first awakening. He went out, had his charioteer take him out, and he saw someone who was very sick, someone who was very old, and a dead body. So all of these things kind of shocked him because he was protected from all of these things. Then the final trip, he saw a young monk with no possessions, full of joy, his face beaming. So each time he would ask his charioteer, who are these people? And so we got the answer. This is a sick person. Everyone gets sick. See him, how much he suffers. This is an old person. Everyone will get old. They'll be tottering on the stick. Might end up lying on the roadside, and everyone dies. This is a corpse. This is a dead person. He was shocked. He didn't know any of these things. He was young, 16 or something. Then, who is this person with the face beaming? And he said, he is a young monk. He's renounced everything. He has no possessions. He has no worries. He has nothing, but filled with joy. So these four visits were enough for that first awakening. So he took off. But how many long years he had to practice very intense austerities? Too much. So much so that he came to the conclusion that we need to follow more of a middle path, that it was too much. But then he took that vow, let this body wither away, let everything turn to dust and ashes. I'm not going to leave my seat until I attain realization. And the whole night he had to fight off these demons that attacked him, who were really in the form of different desires, tempting him, this and that. And then by the time morning came, he had that real awakening, that final awakening, and he was transformed into Buddha, the awakened one. Then we see this two-tiered process with this whole concept of the Kundalini. Kundalini is very appropriate here because we talk about awakening the Kundalini. We have so many beautiful songs. This Jago, Jago Ma, the Jago, Jago Janani. Oh, Mother, awake, awaken from your sleep. Now, what does it mean? That we have this concept that the Divine Mother comes in the form of power, Shakti. This divine power, which is the source of the whole universe. This power, Brahman, the absolute reality, together with his power, the male and the female, together in union, that this represents the explanation for the creation of this universe. But within the body itself, this divine power dwells, sleeping in Muladhara, in the lowest chakra. We have the different centers of the body. For most people, this power, this potential spiritual power remains in the lower three chakras, which means that the mind is dwelling on eating and drinking and sleeping and sense pleasure and enjoyment. That's all. So when we try to awaken this spiritual power, it means that we're raising our consciousness to higher levels. We get to the heart center and we start to see that everything is light. We start to see this materialistic view of the universe is a very short-sighted view. And it goes higher and higher until we talk about the union of the Mother Shakti with Shiva, who dwells in the Sahasrara at the top of the head. This is the real awakening. So the first, we have to awaken the mother sleeping in the Muladhara, sleeping in the lowest center. That means that we're dead to spiritual life. It doesn't mean there's something wrong with us. It means something has to be awakened, because our real nature is spiritual. This is who we are. And we don't know it because there's something within us that's sleeping. This is the whole idea behind this, the concept of awakening. So we have to awaken that spiritual power to start on this path, the spiritual path. But we don't get that final awakening until we have that ultimate union between Shiva and Shakti, or we can say the individual soul and the supreme soul, the individual and God dwelling within, represented as the thousand-petaled lotus at the top of the head. Now, how does this take place? How does this awakening take place? Of course, we have our two different types of awakenings, but we see that different traditions speak about it in different terms, and the experience is actually different. That the spiritual path that we follow determines the parameters of this awakening, the type of awakening that we have. So in the Japanese Zen system, generally, they talk about this satori. Satori is a very sudden, unexpected type of flash of awakening. So it's something that can happen just, we never know, any moment. These monks and practitioners of Zen, they're always ready, always thinking at any moment this can happen. Then we have other traditions, and if we look at, say, Totopuri, Totopuri is following this path of Raja Yoga, meditation. He himself said, when Sri Ramakrishna had his samadhi after 3 days, he said, look, he's done something in 3 days. It took me 40 years of long, hard practice to achieve that. So on the one hand, it may be something quick and sudden. On the other hand, it may take a whole lifetime of spiritual practice. Sri Ramakrishna talks about different types of awakenings. And he uses this term, siddha, that someone who has attained a state of perfection. And he talks about different types that we have. First, there's a very basic distinction that he makes. There's some people who he calls nitya siddhas. That means they're born perfect. Now, for those who are born perfect, that means they have some special mission in life. These are not ordinary souls. These are the great prophets and saints and that we see just seem to be different from the general run of people, with the ease with which they can attain the heights of spirituality and how they found different religious traditions. And so that's a little bit different. Then, for them, it's kind of shaking off the dust of Maya. They still are born with a little Maya. They have to have that awakening, but these are called the nitya siddhas. Then everyone else falls into a different category, and for them also, there are different types. So I want to read from a section Sri Ramakrishna is speaking to the Brahmo devotees. There are two classes of perfect souls, those who attain perfection through spiritual practice, sadhana siddha, and those who attain it through the grace of God. Some farmers irrigate their fields with great labor. Only then can they grow crops. But there are some that do not have to irrigate at all. Their fields are flooded by rain. They don't have to go to the trouble of drawing water. One must practice spiritual discipline laboriously in order to avoid the clutches of Maya. Those who attain liberation through the grace of God, kripa siddha, do not have to labor. Then he adds, but they are few indeed. So we can't count on that one. We can't sit back and say, we'll let grace come. We have to do our spiritual practice. Another place he talks about something he calls hotat, hotat siddha, those who attain liberation very quickly. They have to do something, but still, like somebody who is digging for a well. They think it'll be a long thing, but after a few shovelfuls, they strike an underground spring and water gushes forth. So they don't have to do too much. And then he talks about even swapna siddha, those who have this spiritual awakening in a dream. Of course, that would be nice, but I don't think that happens too often either. So we see that this awakening, especially this final awakening, happens in different ways for different people, and according to their own nature and according to their tradition and their spiritual path. That also plays a large part. But we also find some common features, especially with regard to this initial awakening. And one of the most common features is that we have to experience some type of suffering or some type of tragedy. Something happens in life that makes us take a second look at things. Otherwise, what will stop complacency? If we're going along and everything seems fine, that we have a nice family, we have a nice job, we enjoy our friends, we have parties that we go to, everything is fun, everything is great, then what will stop us from just continuing that way without questioning anything? So we see sometimes it's a great tragedy, sometimes a great shock, sometimes it means just hitting rock bottom, where we get sated with pleasure, where we do so much that we can't stand any more of it. So we find this in very many traditions, that the beginning has something to do with some type of negativity. When we look at Bhagavad Gita, what is the first chapter all about? This is Arjuna Vishada Yoga. This means the yoga, which is a spiritual path. We can say even the awakening, because it's the very first chapter. So the awakening spiritual path that begins with Arjuna's grief. Now, what is his grief? He finds that he's in a battle where he has to fight as his own kinsmen, his cousins and uncles and grandparents and grandfathers and those who were his teachers when he was young, his gurus and everything. So it sets him in a real spin. He doesn't know what to do. He's consumed with guilt and with grief and tries to think of anything that he can think of to get out of fighting in the battle, which is his duty, his obligation to do it. So even in the case of Arjuna, his spiritual path, we can say, starts with this vishada, with this grief, and it's a type of yoga. So it has its spiritual value. It has its spiritual value. We look at Girish Ghosh. Girish Ghosh, he used to say that there's no sin that anyone can think of that I haven't committed. He used to say if you piled it up, it would be as big as Mount Everest, as the Himalayas. He was a drunkard. He was a womanizer. He did everything. They called him a bohemian in those days. Of course, he was a very, very gifted genius, we can say, playwright and actor and father of the Bengali stage, and had a genius for spirituality also, which was hidden, of course, at that time. But it was because he had reached such a low point in life where he felt out of control. He really berated himself for having a complete lack of self-control and ability to avoid things that he knew were not helpful for him. And it was at that stage that he met Sri Ramakrishna. And of course, his life was very quickly transformed. We look at the life of M. Mahendranath Gupta, the recorder of the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. Now, he could have met Sri Ramakrishna at any point in his life. There's no special reason why he had to meet him when he did meet him. When did he meet him? When his family situation became so painful to him that he was about to commit suicide. Is it just a coincidence? I mean, he's living in the same city as Sri Ramakrishna. He must have heard about him from Keshav. Right? He could have seen him at any time. Why then? Because the mind was most prepared at that time. It had to sink to that state where he was really ready to give up his life in order for him to wake up to a new kind of life. So he always credited Sri Ramakrishna, not simply with saving him from a spiritual point of view, giving him a new spiritual life, but giving him a real life that otherwise he might have committed suicide if it hadn't been for that first meeting. Even we can say in the lives of Sri Ramakrishna and Swami Vivekananda, they both had to experience the death of the father when they were relatively young. Sri Ramakrishna, even younger, Swamiji, a late teenager or 20, something like that. And in each case, it made them more introspective. It made them more aware of the transitory nature of the world. Not that we really compare them to others, but still, we see, even for them, that there was a certain value to this, the shock that came at losing a father at a young age. And in the case of Sri Ramakrishna, having to leave the family and go to the big city with his brother and look for a job and all of those things. And Swami Vivekananda also having to worry about his family not starving even. So these things are very important in spiritual life to somehow reach this bottom point. There's a wonderful story that Girish Ghosh put into the form of a play. This story of Wilwa Mangal. It's a very nice story. There was a man who fell in love with a prostitute. And it was a type of love that was all-consuming for him. He thought about her day and night. She didn't care much for him. She didn't treat him very well or anything, but he was just completely out of control. So he had to see her. And one night, there was a terrible storm. There were heavy rain and winds, and it was a dark night. There was no moon, and no ferryman would take the boat across the river. There was no way to cross to get to where his lover was. Chintamani was her name, Chintamani, where she was. So he decided to swim across the river, and it was very rough waters, and he was practically drowning. And somehow he found a raft that was floating, and he grabbed hold of the raft. And holding onto the raft, swimming, he got close to the shore. And then in order to get on the shore, there was some big logs there. So he climbed in the logs and walked across them. Then he had to climb a wall. So how to climb this wall? Fortunately, he saw that there was a rope that was hanging down. He grabbed hold of the rope, and through that he climbed over, and he went to where his Chintamani was living. So he went to see her, and she said, "How did you come? You're such a fool in this weather. You came, you couldn't stay away." And then she said, "What is that awful smell?" And he said, "Yes, there is an awful smell," and he couldn't figure out why. She said, "Let's go see." So they went. The raft that he grabbed hold of was a corpse. It was a rotting dead body, and his mind was so fixed on Chintamani that he didn't even realize it. Then the log that he walked across was an alligator. He didn't even notice it. So then she said, "Then how did you climb?" He said, "That rope that was there, he thought it was a snake. It was a snake that had his head that got stuck there, and the rest of it was hanging down. Holding on to that snake, he crossed." And then she said, "What a fool you are. If your mind can be so absorbed in me that you completely forget this world, just think how easily you could realize God." Now, why she said this, we don't know. How easily you could realize God with that power to concentrate the mind that way. And that did it. And he said, "Yes, you're right. I'm wasting my whole life." And from that day on, he left. He became a wandering mendicant, spending his life calling on God. Okay. So anyhow, this was at Wilwa Mangal. But even after he left, that doesn't mean that was the end of the job. Even after he left, one day he was sitting for meditation, and he heard the voice of a young woman. And again, these old samskaras came back. "Oh, it must be a beautiful young woman. Let me go see." And then he went and he saw, and then he said, "Give me your knitting needles." Yeah. And he put out his own eyes. He said, these rascal eyes will never look with lust on a woman again. So Sur Das. Yeah. Any other different traditions and different stories? Yeah, I heard it as a sword does. And it doesn't matter. But the point is that he became a great saint after that. But that was a gradual transition like that. So sometimes it can be very gradual. We look at the life of M, we see no indication of, first of all, that Thakur touched him and he went into samadhi. We don't read about that. But we see his life, a very gradual unfolding, so that by the time he became elderly, we can say, he was considered to be a highly realized soul. And even the monks of the order would send the young monks who joined to him for instruction and for holy company to make pranam to him and everything, though he wasn't a monk himself. So in his case, there was a very gradual awakening unfolding. Sometimes it's lots of little awakenings, little by steps, sometimes leaps and bounds. It happens in all different ways. So this process of spiritual rebirth or spiritual awakening is different for everyone. And in some cases, it's something very, very dramatic and very radical. We see some people and we don't recognize them. We say, oh, how they've become transformed. Then we see other people, they say, oh, after a whole lifetime of spiritual practice, you seem the same. But it's beneath the surface. Sometimes we ourselves don't know and others don't recognize that this process of awakening is taking place on a very subtle level. This transformation is taking place on a level that no one can even notice or even see. So we shouldn't be fooled. Very often we think that we're not making any spiritual practice. This is a terrible thing. That we should never think that. We should be convinced that nothing goes in vain. Every time we call on God, every time we sit for meditation, every time we serve someone seeing God in them, that the effect is there. It's there's no way to stop that effect. And that this process of transformation is the essential key, because we reach a turning point. We get transformed at a certain point, and then we skip to another level. Some other type of awakening takes place. So we all have to feel, on the one hand, that we've had that initial awakening. We wouldn't be here otherwise. So somehow we've all, through the grace of God or through our own karma or through reaching some, experiencing some low point in life, whatever, we've reached the point where we have some golden, spiritual golden life and that we're striving. So we're all in the same boat, that we're trying to do some type of spiritual practice. We really have to do something until we reach that point where it's natural and spontaneous. So we have to strive, but we realize an interesting thing, that it's grace all along. That this distinction between self-effort and grace is not a very good and very clear distinction. That this grace is working. We saw it with the ministers of the king. This is also grace. It's grace that gives us that initial awakening. It's grace that gives us this final awakening. The other thing we find that's very interesting is that it's gradual and sudden at the same time. Sri Ramakrishna asked the very nice question, if you turn the light on in a room, does the room get bright little by little or all at once? So it's instantaneous. The finding the room, groping in the dark, finding the light switch, that may take time. But once we find it, once we flip it up, then it happens all at once. So we never know. There are some types of spiritual practices that focus very much on this idea that it could be right now, it could be the second. That awakening, we have to be vigilant. We have to be ready for it. We have to be prepared. Every time we sit for meditation, we shouldn't think, let me finish my meditation, my japa and everything. We should think, this may be the day. This may be the time when I have that awakening. When something happens unexpected, something happens that I don't feel that I even earned or I deserve. This is the whole concept of grace. This grace doesn't have to be God sitting in heaven and lightning bolt coming down and striking someone. It just means that something takes over for us. It's not due to our own self-effort, and the experience that we have seems to be so much more than the price that we paid for it. This is really the essential feature of grace, that we don't feel, it seems to be undeserved. It seems to be undeserved, that it's too great a prize for the small price of a little bit of spiritual practice that we've done. So we need to strive for that final awakening, for that ultimate enlightenment. When, what happens? All of our doubts disappear. All of the knots of the heart get removed. And this karma gets dissolved. This karma, which is a type of bondage for us, which may lead to a future lifetime, so all of that gets burnt up. It gets burnt up, so the only thing that's remaining is whatever is keeping the body alive. Prarabdha karma. This is the only thing that remains. Everything else disappears at that point. And we see the world with new eyes. There's such tremendous clarity of vision that we truly feel that we were sleeping before and we've woken up. Or that this experience of the world now is like a dream, sometimes a nightmare. This, you read these beautiful letters of Swami Paramahansa, he's always talking about that, kuswapna. That we can wake up from that in this very lifetime. Of course, when this body goes, there also may be another awakening, and we look back at this whole lifetime as a long dream that way. But even now, we can feel that there's such clarity of vision, that we see God everywhere and everyone, everything a manifestation of the divine, that we were sleepwalking before, that we were living in a type of hazy dream world that we didn't understand. We took it to be real and it wasn't real. So this is that other aspect of awakening. So on this special day is Easter, the time when the whole Western world, and of course many in India and other places, are thinking about this idea of resurrection, of rebirth. I thought this would be a very nice time for us also to think about this idea of awakening, to try to feel that each and every moment is a type of awakening. Every day we wake up in the morning, it's a new day. This is our chance to have that ultimate experience, because we need to keep enthusiasm in spiritual life. This is a very, very important thing. Before I joined the order, I was given this one piece of advice. A couple of things, but this is one. Keep the fire burning. This is the only thing that was one of our senior monks. Keep the fire burning. We have to keep fanning it, otherwise it goes out. In spiritual life, we have to keep fanning that fire so that we really feel that, yeah, every day, let me try my best. This may be the day when I can have that real awakening. So let us take a few minutes now, sit quietly, and try to feel that this season of rebirth, the season when all the flowers and everything coming back up, is an ideal time for us to also try to not just have that awakening, but rekindle that enthusiasm for spiritual life that we need.
Tamaso ma jyotirmaya mrityorma amritam gamaya abhiravirmayeti rudrayate takshanam mukham te namam pahi nityam om shanti 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 harihi om tatsat.
Lead us from the unreal to the real. Lead us from darkness to light. Lead us from death to immortality. Light us through and through, O Lord, and protect us evermore with thy compassionate face. Om peace, peace, peace be unto us.